activism or intolerance, cancel culture on the rise. When former President Barack Obama dipped his toe into the culture wars last month, social media exploded. In a public onstage conversation, Obama urged young people to be more accepting of ambiguity in the world and be a little less quick to judge others who have said or done something objectionable. Afterwards, some thanked Obama for being a voice of reason, saying the cancel culture has gone too far. Others criticized him for being an out-of-touch boomer and protective of the kind of people who need to be called out. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, cancel culture, which is related to call-out culture, has emerged from college campuses to the mainstream. Is it a powerful and potent form of activism, or the modern-day equivalent of the Scarlet Letter? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. These days, all sorts of new terms and trends are popping up, one of which is cancel culture. It's when a person does something that's deemed unacceptable and that person gets shunned in real life or on social media. We're going to discuss how cancel culture came about and how it affects the way our society interacts. Joining me in our Portland studio, Theo Green. He's assistant professor of sociology at Bowdoin College. In our Bangor studio, Judith Rosenbaum is an associate professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at the University of Maine. And also joining us from Bangor, Liz Terrio, who is opinion editor for the University of Maine student newspaper. She is a senior at UMaine studying journalism and political science. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you think it's appropriate for anyone to get canceled? Have you seen it happen? Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. I know this is going to be such an interesting conversation. Theo, I'm going to start with you. I gave a real vague definition just then. I said cancel culture is when a person does something that's deemed unacceptable and gets shunned. I understand you now teach this. How do you define cancel culture?
Yes, I now have to teach it because so many of my students bring it up in classes, and we've been confronted with it in a lot of different contexts in academia as well. I think of cancel culture as a sort of boycott. It is a boycott or a blacklist that now is perpetuated by social media, but it has always existed in some form. We've seen various examples of cancel culture taking place all going back into the 18th century. But cancel culture, I think, really picked up steam, I think, with the rise of the Black Lives Matter and Me Too moments, where people began to first call out people who were doing offending behavior. So cancel culture is a cousin of call out culture. And then from there, we've decided to move to a more extreme once a person has done something offensive, and then that's where we get this notion of canceling, like as in the media or television shows, when we cancel a show we don't like.
Yeah, so the old expression might be, I'm done with you, and the new expression is, we're going to do this on social media, and we're going to try to get other people on board.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the interesting thing about it being on social media. It's such a democratic tool. It diffuses really quickly, and people jump on board. So, you know, the benefits of it is that it can be a movement that diffuses quickly. The downsides is that it does, you know, doesn't necessarily have the kind of nuance that you might have but through reading many articles or many different kinds of stories before people decide to cancel someone. So we can cancel people prematurely as a result.
Judith, talk about the kinds of forms that cancel culture can take.
Well, as Theo mentioned, cancel culture really goes way, way back. I think we all remember in kindergarten when, you know, everybody decided not to pick on the kid that did something or not to talk to the kid who picked on somebody else. Today in social media, what you can really see is that people will badmouth somebody, you know, this is what happened. And bad mouth obviously is a normative term, but you know, where people will say so-and-so did this to me, this is awful. So they will call somebody out. There's examples where people will literally boycott shows. They will boycott performances by people. They will not buy products anymore. And what we're really seeing is that social media enables this, not just because of their speed, but also because of the way in which they create connections between people. So, you know, on social media, the platforms are really built around what we call affective connection. So people who feel like they are in a group. We are in a group. We are together. We don't like you. And so we as a group are going to now boycott you. We're not going to talk about you. We're not going to go to your shows. We're not going to buy your products. And this is because we feel a certain kind of way about what you just did. So it's really the effective connectivity of social media that makes that all, you know, possible. And that really perpetuates that. One thing that Theo said that I thought was really interesting is he said it diffuses really quickly. And I was reading an article in Time magazine the other day where the author brought that up as well. Is we talk about cancel culture as being really devastating to the victims. And perhaps that's what Barack Obama was talking about, right? That we're destroying people's lives. But this author raised the question, how effective is cancel culture really? You know, I mean, they tried to cancel Taylor Swift back in 2016, I believe. And I mean, she's still selling out concerts, right? Mm. She's still making money. So, yes, we talk about this thing as something that's really awful, but how effective is it really? And that's something that I'm really curious to talk about more today.
And it's interesting, too, because Liz, you wrote a piece for the paper, and that was one of your points in your opinion piece about cancel culture, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Tell me how you came. I want to back up a little bit. And, you know, we're having a conversation here of people who are in a different generation than you are. Cancel culture has been a term for folks in your age range much longer as it has been for Gen Xers and boomers. So tell me when you first heard the phrase and what it means to you as a college student.
I think I first heard it in the instance that Judith mentioned with Taylor Swift, actually. And Judith and I were talking a little bit before we started today, and I had said that I really started noticing cancel culture on Twitter in particular with hashtags. And so I'd just be on Twitter scrolling through, and on the side there'd be trending hashtags, and I would see hashtag cancel Taylor Swift or Taylor Swift is canceled. And so it's something I see a lot just kind of casually as I'm, you know, on social media at the end of the day or in between classes or something like that. And so it's something that happens almost individually, I find, between people my age as they're on social media themselves and, like, not necessarily in person. I'm sure that my friends and I and other people my age have conversations with one another about it, but it's something that seems to happen more on, like, the social media side of things, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, Liz. Canceling can go with somebody famous, like Taylor Swift, but this is something that can happen to regular people too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that I think is less widespread if it's not on social media per se, because you're not having this almost like mob mentality of people all over the world seeing the same thing. But, you know, if someone decides that you said something and you're telling your friends about it and your friends decide, you know what, we're not going to hang out with that person anymore. We're not going to talk to them. We're not going to include them in even group chats or things like that. It absolutely can happen in person on a more like day-to-day level.
You know, you mentioned the phrase mob mentality, Liz, old-fashioned sociological phenomenon. Theo, also, you know, we're talking about history, and what popped into my mind reading about this, many things did, but one of the many things was, is the scarlet letter version of being canceled.
Oh, absolutely. I was listening to Hamilton a couple days ago, and I remember about how the affair that Hamilton had in the 1790s, right, effectively canceled him from becoming president. It killed his political ambition. So we have seen cancel culture in many different manifestations throughout history. You can think of the Hollywood blacklist, McCarthyism as a form of cancel culture. And again, as I was saying earlier, you know, that form used to be in the hands of the elites. There were certain kinds of gatekeepers gatekeepers who were responsible for deciding who was going to be canceled at a particular time. And again, with social media, because it's in the hands of everyone, we now see that people can wield tremendous amount of power through these kinds of affective connections and being able to respond in a much faster fashion than we have seen before.
It seems to me there are pros and cons. It seems to me that a pro is that people who maybe didn't have much of a voice before, disenfranchised groups, now have a lot of power. But a con may be that just by definition, cancel culture is a mass of people, and I'm reading from the Urban Dictionary here, quick to judge and slow to question. It's so quick.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we can also one of the things I'm interested in talking about is what happens when we've canceled someone that we've grown up with or someone that we have a deep connection with. So as a child of the 80s, two icons that have now been canceled have been Bill Cosby and Michael Jackson. And so I think about, particularly with Bill Cosby growing up watching The Cosby Show as an African-American, thinking about the powerful impact it had in terms of what I could imagine I myself being. And now that we've canceled him, right, recognizing the horrific things he's done, how do you deal with the material, the work that has become foundational to who I am now as a professor that has been inspired by his work? The same thing with Michael Jackson. I mean, we have listened to his music for such a long time. His songs are amazing. And the responsibility we now have to think about the things he has done over the course of his life. And now many people have effectively canceled him too. And so what do we do with his music? What do we do with the legacy of these people that have been so formulative to who we are in our lives?
And Theo, have you come to terms with that personally?
I'm still struggling with it every day. I out myself. I still watch The Cosby Show every once in a while, but people give me funny looks when I do, because, again, I think there's still a lot of things that I can learn and pick up from it. And that's one of the things that I have to teach my students about, too, how we grapple with the material, which is often knowledge. There's been a number of academics who've been recently canceled in sociology. And how do we deal with the material that can be so foundational to a line of thinking and yet realize that the person who is responsible for it might have done some things that we find problematic at the same time.
Judith, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I think I really agree with the statement that cancel culture can be democratizing. You know, now we have groups of people, women, African-Americans, other minorities who are able to call out those who have engaged in wrongdoings that would have otherwise just gone completely unnoticed, right? Because the elites were doing the gatekeeping. As several people have been mentioned, it can also, you know, kind of sometimes go a little bit too far. And in doing that, it's important to keep in mind that we use social media to perform an identity, right? Ultimately, we're all on social media to get the likes, to get the retweets, the regrams, you know, the comments. So social media is about status maintenance. And one of the reasons cancel culture works so well and is so popular on social media is because one of the ways in which we maintain status is by putting other people down. Again, that is not to negate some of the horrible things these people have done, but it's important to keep in mind, you know, to what extent is this us as a society calling people like Bill Cosby and Michael Jackson out for, you know, for their terrible behaviors? And to what degree is it us being herding animals and wanting to be at the top of the food chain and liked by everybody else in our group?
I'm wondering, there's been a lot ever since President Obama gave this public lecture. I guess it was a conversation on stage at Harvard. He actually didn't use the phrase cancel culture, but he actually said to young people to sort of be a little more understanding. I'm quoting here, this idea of purity and you're never compromised, you're always politically woke and all that stuff. You should get over that quickly. What President Obama said in his several sentences there, a lot of people were really grateful and felt as though he needed to, it was important that someone of his stature ask us all to be a little more understanding. On the other hand, many younger people were very angry. They felt like he was finger wagging and scolding them and telling them and felt like he was out of touch. And I'm wondering, Liz, did you feel that way? Did you feel like President Obama was out of touch when he made those comments?
Not necessarily. I think it is definitely a fine line between, if you're taking things too far and thinking that you're ignoring a problem entirely. I think, in particular for me, and I don't like to speak in generalization for everyone my age, but for myself, I feel the need to you know, call people out on things that I see as them performing wrongdoings. And if they're hurting other people, I think that it is correct and necessary for them to know that they are hurting those people. But at some point, I do think there needs to be that level of understanding and reflection almost on the by the people who are the ones doing the calling out. Because like I said in my article, Kimberly Foster, who is the founder of the YouTube channel For Harriet, has a video where she says, you can't cancel everyone, you know, and you can't be constantly calling everyone out and just constantly shunning them. So instead of just canceling, maybe what we should do is ask them to change. Because if you just shun and if you just push out, suddenly these people, you know, they respond with anger. They don't understand what's going on. Maybe they also don't have that reflection to understand the other points of view. So instead of responding strictly with anger and we just say, hey, you're out of here, we say, hey, this is wrong. You've said this. You've done this. This is who it has hurt. In the future, we need you to change or, you know, we'll kick you out then or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And Thea, what about your students in the class that you teach on this? Is the conversation similar to what Liz is saying?
The conversation is very similar. And it takes a minute to sort of pull students to think about certain kinds of people or certain circumstances with a little bit more empathy. You know, just thinking about, something that Liz was saying in terms of, and even what President Obama was saying in terms of, you know, I think it's the cancel culture is a part of this sort of hashtag culture where we feel that we can do enough by simply just tweeting something or sharing something. And it actually, again, doesn't replace doing the research, the kind of nuance, the kind of empathy that we may have for people who, you know, there are people who've done really horrific things who probably should be canceled right away. And then people who say things or say the wrong thing, who, you know, might deserve a chance to apologize, who might deserve a chance for redemption. Being quick to you know, judge people simply because of things that, you know, I mean, we've seen, you know, there's patterns of behavior over time that you know, deserve cancellation because we have the evidence. And then there are people who may say something or say the wrong thing, and all of a sudden they too become a part of this cancel culture without any sort of explanation or opportunity to apologize. And so, you know, pushing my students to think with more nuance is something that I've been struggling with for quite some time, but hopefully we'll be getting there.
And it's so true, because it's this huge gray area, right? Like both Theo and Liz are saying, yeah, there's people who deserve to be canceled right away. And there's a group of people who just make mistakes. And I think what happens on social media is a lot of us are anonymous. And so we feel emboldened to just go after people. Again, is that really to do good, or is that just to enhance our own status? It's so easy to sit back and judge everybody else. You know, and like Thea was saying, who might have done something wrong once, as opposed to a pattern of behaviors. And I think it's very important to consider that nuance, and also consider, you know, would I say this to someone's face? Or am I saying this right now because I'm behind my computer or on my phone and they don't really know who I am?
We're talking about the rise of the cancel culture on Maine Calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Weilers, committed to offering a colorfully curated mix of local goods, clothing, toys, and gifts on Main Street in downtown Brunswick. And Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com.
Next time on The World, European soccer has a problem.
Racism in the stadiums and outside the stadiums.
Games interrupted by racist chants and heckling against black players on what used to be all-white teams. What top officials in European soccer are doing and not doing to support black players on The World.
That's coming up later today at 3 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what does Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky have to say about Trump, Putin, and the impeachment hearings? Last Saturday, Time correspondent Simon Schuster interviewed the Ukrainian president. Schuster will join us from Kyiv to talk about Zelensky and ties between Trump, his allies, and oligarchs. Join us.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, cancel culture. Why has it become so prevalent? What does it mean exactly? And how does it affect people? Joining me on the program today, Judith Rosenbaum, who's associate professor at UMaine in the Department of Communication and Journalism. Liz Terrio, opinion editor for UMaine's student newspaper. And Theo Green, assistant professor of sociology at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Amy Wood. She is a psychologist, author, speaker, and executive coach. Amy, thanks for calling in. I'm sorry, Amy, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Terrific. Yeah. So what is it about human nature that gives us the urge to shun or cancel other people?
Well, I think it has to do a lot with the way the human brain works. You know, the human brain likes things to be easy, to be categorized, to be black and white. We've used the word nuance a lot on the show today. And, you know, the brain hates nuance because nuance is more difficult than just making a quick decision and shutting things down. And if you go back to prehistoric times, it made a lot of sense to make those quick decisions because we were in constant danger. We were living in caves. We had to decide very quickly if there was some sort of threat we needed to extinguish. And we had to cancel other people outside of our own tribe, if you will, because people carried germs. We didn't have strong immune systems. So if we interacted with people outside of our tribe, we might get killed from the germs. So, you know, it served a purpose at one time to be this reactive. But now that we can afford to have nuance, we can afford to take the time to really get to know people, it's really not in our service to make these quick judgments.
How does it affect people to be shut out from their social group or their profession, to be canceled?
Well, we're all social beings and we're all complicated people. And even those who have done real wrongs, you know, that they can't correct, even those people that we should shut out, you know, they suffer greatly from that. And the best thing that we can do with these people that we want to cancel is try to see things from their perspective and understand first and foremost that they're human just like we are, and they're complicated just like we are, and there's reasons behind their behavior. I'm not saying that there are excuses that are plausible or reasonable, but there's reasons why people do the things that they do. And if we could just try to understand that a little bit more and understand the need for connection and also understand that one reason people may commit these acts that cause the cancellations, it's because they already feel disconnected.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for calling in. Amy Wood, a psychologist, speaker, and author. We're going to go to Lisa, who's calling from Ellsworth. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
I had an experience, and I don't know if I'm interpreting the cancel culture correctly, but I think that it had to do with that. This was a couple of years ago on Facebook in a liberal-leaning anti-Trump kind of group, and I don't know if you remember, there was a woman, an African-American woman, who protested on the Statue of Liberty. She climbed it, and they had to shut the place down, there were a lot of tourists that were evidently had to be turned away, and they were very angry and everything like that. And this was the topic of discussion in this group. And I expressed the thought that this was a poorly thought-out means of protest. And I got jumped on, told that I was a white privileged woman, was not allowed to express this opinion. I got jumped on by a 20-something white male student. No one else stepped in to the group conversation to defend my point of my opinion, which was I was just trying to direct the conversation toward what is a good method of protest. Instead, it became about me. And I dropped out of the group because apparently they were a group, to me, of non-thinking people. You had to subscribe to certain ideas in order to be a member of this group.
Sure. And Lisa, that's thank you for so much for calling. Judith, this is what you're talking about with nuance, correct?
Exactly. I mean, she's talking, and I'm thinking this is exactly the problem we have with social media, is that people exist in these, they exist in echo chambers and filter bubbles because that's what they want, right? People are not comfortable being exposed to an opinion that is different than theirs. And in this case, I think we can agree that Lisa's opinion might have been different from what other people thought, but it was definitely not egregious enough to warrant some kind of canceling. But by doing that, they effectively stopped any conversation they could have had that might have led to some sort of growth on either party side, right?
Lisa, thanks so much. Elaine on Facebook writes, Obama's comments were a welcome bit of sanity. I worry that young people are learning a kind of anti-intellectualism. Think as I do, or you are unacceptable as a person. This is a danger to the future of our society. Theo?
Wow. sorry. I think the notion, I think many of us think about running into a danger today and being anti-intellectual because I think our positions are now, I think, accelerated by the current administration is captured in 280 characters where, you know, President Trump can say things in tweets and that is in that, you know, elements of policy, elements of ideologies, political points of view. And so I think, you know, there is a danger for us to think that we are moving away from, again, that question of doing the kind of research we need to do to make, you know, political, to state political positions, to ask questions, to push back and even challenge, right, things that people say that we disagree with. And so, you know, I have that same concern. And again, I think it's one of the reasons why I try to push my students to think with more nuance and more texture and do more reading.
Liz, before we move in, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in particular when we're talking about young people in particular, they are angry. People my age are angry and they feel that the only way that they can engage or see change is by jumping on people and by attacking them because it's you know, how dare someone consider this or how do they not see how this is affecting me or affecting other people or hurting them? And I think there's less of that pause, that consideration, that, you know, switching perspectives, because it's just, like Theo said, so easy and so quick, you know, 280 characters, that's all you have. And so it seems like the conversation is already limited, and now people are just limiting it more by, you know, jumping on people, not asking them their side of, like, point of view, not asking them to elaborate, and just stopping the conversation there by saying, you know what, you have a different opinion than me, I don't want to talk to you. And that, you know, that hurts our democracy, of course.
From Jane in Falmouth, we're in a moment right now when extremely far-right views are being normalized, and it's very important to remember this can't be allowed to happen. One of the biggest weapons we have against this in a healthy society is social sanction, letting people know that at the Thanksgiving table, at work, in our everyday lives, the behaviors that hurt women, minorities, gay and trans people, and other marginalized groups are not okay. We need people to actually see they'll be lonelier and less successful if they're expressing those views. Thoughts?
It's absolutely true. I mean, that's very true. But, and I hate to say this, if we isolate people with extremist views, that's not going to make the extremist views going to go away. I worry that those people are just going to find each other, as they have, and they do on places like 4chan and Reddit and 8chan, and that the ideas still exist, but away from mainstream view. So I'm really on, you know, I'm kind of divided on this because, yes, we should tell people that is completely not acceptable. But we should also try to engage in a dialogue instead of pushing them away and pushing them into a place where their ideas might become even more extreme.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree because I think I said something about this in the article. If you just shun somebody and you ostracize them and they don't understand why, if we don't, you know, it shouldn't be the responsibility, of course, of someone to explain to someone else why their actions or their statements are hurting people. But I think, unfortunately, that's what we have come to. Mm-hmm. And so when we don't do that and someone feels ostracized and lonely, they themselves respond with anger and they respond with frustration. And there is not going to be that chance for, you know, connection and understanding and a change in views. Instead, it almost solidifies them.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I think we have moved toward in terms of political debate is that the political perspectives we take are so tied to identity. So when people challenge an argument as a, you know, we think of it as attacking a person because it's central to our values, it's central to who we are. And I think that becomes one of the reasons why people, you know, in terms of Lisa's example earlier, right, they didn't necessarily attack her, argue against the thing she was saying. They were attacking her, right? They were calling her out for her levels of quote-unquote privilege. And we have to, I think, get to back to that place where we can be, the way to be a democracy is to challenge ideas. And those ideas can change and mold, and they're not necessarily fundamentally tied to who we are as people. It's not an attack on us.
We'll go to Julie in Waterboro. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I am new to this term, cancel culture. I'm a baby boomer, so I haven't really heard that term before until today. But I did witness it recently when Pete Buttigieg, who's running for president, first gay man to run, I guess, he was asked if he thinks that churches that refuse to perform same-sex marriage should lose their tax exemption status. And he said that they should not. And I watched as the gay community, you know, started to pull away from him because of his view. He's trying so hard to be a centrist and please everyone. He's losing his own community.
Yeah, Julie, thank you. Theo, in your view, is that cancel culture or is that something else?
It's a combination of call-out culture. I think it's moving, you know, if we think of call-out and cancel culture as a spectrum, you know, it can be some people do cancel him for those kinds of statements. But then there is, I think with any kind of contingent, a person we cancel, there's also a counter movement that can happen. People can run to a person's defense when people try to cancel someone.
All right. Thanks for your call, Judith. We'll go to Alfred on Facebook. In America, we're supposed to be tolerant of different viewpoints and help each other learn. Cancel culture is harmful to society and reflects a rigidly moralistic approach akin to the worst parts of Puritanism. And we'll go to Aaron calling from South Portland. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. So, yeah, I was kind of echoing the same point there. With and you mentioned morality, it does seem almost religious in nature, you know, with, and some of that religious language I think we've lost, you know, with ideas of, you know, if someone does hurt somebody, you know, in religious terms we'd call that a sin, but that doesn't end the story. It doesn't cancel the individual. That is an opportunity for repentance and forgiveness. And I was just thinking about in practical terms. You know, I'm a father. I have two children. They're constantly, you know, offending each other and, you know, committing cancelable offenses against each other. But I don't, you know, teach them that that's okay. We have to work through our problems and we have to see each other as human beings. And I'm really, really worried. And I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm in the middle here, sandwiched between these you guys. Or the boomers and the millennials, but it worries me because I see as kind of an inhumane way of treating people. If that makes sense.
Yeah, Judith.
Yes, I agree, and also no. Here I go again with my divisiveness. Is yes, cancel culture can go too far, like we've said. But if we keep in mind that there's scores of people who were never heard, right? Women whose sexual assault stories went untold or even worse, unbelieved. Now, the hashtag MeToo has given them a space and the ability to say to people like Harvey Weinstein, enough, no more, or Louis C.K., enough, no more. To me, that is a valuable aspect of cancel culture. Not all of it is valuable, but I think recognizing that issues and ideas and people that were just completely ignored are now on the forefront, I think that is a conversation worth having.
Erin, thanks so much for your call. I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, which is President Obama and his remarks last month. One of the points that President Obama or former President Obama was making, Theo, and I think you touched on this a little bit ago, is that sending a tweet is a different thing than activism. And that was something that hit a nerve with some people. And I'm reading to you from here. This was a column in the New York Times by a journalist, a young journalist named Ernest Owens. He writes, of course, we take part in more traditional activism, but today we have additional tools. Why wouldn't we use them? Why, why can't Twitter be a tool for social activism?
Twitter can be a tool for social activism. I think we can't, however, use Twitter alone as the means to which we engage in activism. It does not replace us going into the voting booths and voting for politicians, voting them in and out of office. And we've seen how Black Lives Matter was a movement that began on social media, but then it went into the streets. People, did the protests, they did the marches. And so, we have to think about these tools in conversation with more traditional kinds of protests. There's lots of advantages that come through this kind of social media activism. We just can't use it as the sole basis to engage in politics. That armchair activism is just not, that's what we used to call it back in the day. It wasn't effective then, and it isn't effective now.
All right. Well, we're talking about the concept of the cancel culture. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Senior Guide, an online resource of services and information for older Mainers and their families. More at maineseniorguide.com. And Community Concepts, inviting you to help foster individuals and families to thrive with a donation today at ccimaine.org.
Technology companies like Facebook and Google are facing more and more regulation, not in the U.S., but in Europe. Can the EU's regulations make big tech better for everyone without stifling innovation?
The European policymakers no longer want to compete. They want to subjugate American tech companies.
It's Europe and American big tech on the next Intelligence Squared US.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Public app allows you to take Maine Public Radio and Classical along with Maine Public Television with you anywhere and anytime. The Maine Public app is available for both Apple and Android smartphones and tablets, and it also gives you access to many of your favorite television programs from both Maine Public Television and PBS. And it's also easy to either listen to or read Maine Public Radio news reports. You can easily find the Maine Public app in both the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store, and it's free.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how cancel culture is affecting society. My guest, Liz Terrio, who's a UMaine student and opinion editor for the student newspaper Maine Campus. Theo Green is a Bowdoin Assistant Professor of Sociology, and Judith Rosenbaum, UMaine Associate Professor of Communication and Journalism. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Theo, we've been talking mainly about people and cancel culture, but there are other things out there, sort of like cultural objects. We were talking through the break about the song Baby It's Cold Outside, a song, not a person.
Right. And, with the holiday season, whenever people play it, the debate goes on. But, you think about a song that was written in the 1940s that was intended as this flirtation between, a couple. And now in the era of Me Too, the meanings have changed to the point where people don't play that song anymore. Or John Legend tried to rewrite the words in terms of a Me Too moment, and people were very upset about that. And so there's, we think about certain kinds of, we talked a lot about people and canceling people, but there are, artworks that we cancel. There's television shows like, we talked about The Cosby Show earlier that we sort of have canceled in the wake of Bill Cosby or not listening to Michael Jackson's music. But there, there's lots of different ways in which, cancel culture can pervade the social world. And so it's not just people at all.
We'll go to Andrew, who's calling from Halifax, Nova Scotia. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm enrolled at a school called University of King's College in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And it's, you can typify it as one of these small liberal arts schools that has really intense call-out cancel culture, because all of the students are armed with a classical education and social justice movements, so they look to enact them on their own student body, oftentimes in arenas where it's not necessary. So I find this whole conversation very interesting.
Yeah, Liz, is what Andrew's talking about resonate with you? I know you're not at a small liberal arts college, you're at a big university, but is what he says something you can relate to?
Absolutely. There has been a lot of conversation happening on our campus recently about the UMaine College Republicans in particular, and I won't get into too much detail about that because it was rather controversial for a large amount of time. And just in short, they were posting certain things on their social media, on their Facebook, that were generating a lot of call-out culture and cancel culture from members of the UMaine student body. And so even though our university is bigger, we still have a lot of organizations, a lot of different activist groups that, you know, kind of take it upon themselves to practice, you know, what they're passionate about and what they're learning with the behaviors that they're seeing on their own campus. So absolutely, it's still something that's happening.
Andrew,
I have a question, Judith.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Actually, for Liz and Andrew, because clearly I'm not a college student anymore, but what's it like to be on a campus where there is that cancel call out culture? I mean, do you get afraid to speak up? Do you police what you say? How does that affect like your daily life?
Andrew?
I can talk to that point. I've been called out a number of times in class for things that I've said in the classroom, which are then quoted not verbatim on Twitter, things that I haven't actually said. And it affects my relationships with my professors and my relationships with my fellow peers, and it makes it difficult to kind of stand up for what you believe in, because there's a certain canon of interpretation which you're allowed to posit in the classroom. But then also it's complicated because it limits the way that you're allowed to read text, and it limits the way that you're allowed to engage with students in your group. I've been told when I tried to stand up against someone's opinion in defense of a professor in their syllabus that I wasn't allowed to voice that opinion just by sheer despotism of custom. So it's frightening. It's a frightening thing to experience, because as soon as you get on the wrong side of these people, there's no limit to what they can't say about you, even if you're just voicing an opinion surely in theory, which I can understand the negative side of, right? But
Liz?
It is frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, in my personal experience, you know, I'm the opinion section editor, so every week I write an editorial, and that's something that the other editors at the main campus and I sit around a table and decide what we want to write about. And sometimes I do have that pause where I'm like, is what I'm going to say in this article, you know, going to get me called out, going to get the paper called out? Personally, as a journalist, I have, like, undertaken, I have accepted that responsibility and that possibility, because that's what I choose to do. But I also agree with the point that, you know, there's a lot of this "you can't have that opinion" conversation that's happening a lot, where people are saying, not just saying you're wrong, they're just saying you're not allowed to have it. And I think, again, that circles back to the whole, you know, we're not having discussions, we're not having conversations, we're just saying you're wrong and you can't even be that way, which is a whole other thing. But yeah, it's happening a lot on campuses with students in classes, for sure. I've had that happen in a lot of my political science classes. And on campus, out on the University of Maine has a mall, a big open yard where students will do protests, or there'll be flag raisings, and there'll be students gathered together, like, arguing with each other almost, and, you know, causing scenes.
Well, and I think this is what you and Andrew are both raising is really interesting, right? The fact that You know, when we teach about movements, especially on college campuses, we, you know, we raise up like the Berkeley movements in the 1960s and those student rights movements, which were huge demonstrations that shut down the institution. And now that there's, you know, the institution has, colleges have virtually co-opted these movements in a lot of different ways, right, incorporate them into academia, academic pursuits. It's very difficult for students to be able to engage in these kinds of movements where you can see allyship in action, right, in the ways in which we saw white allies in the civil rights movement or straight allies in the gay movement marching in the streets. And so I think it's one of the ways in which we see how this kind of culture first operates to provide students with that voice. But because, you know, it's words and it's rhetoric, we often run into this sort of slippage as to who has ownership over that discourse, right? Whether that's going to be co-opted by somebody with more privilege.
Andrew, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Ben calling from Portland. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Yes, I'm a teacher, and I'm really interested in this idea of, you know, looking at the nuance of everything that you're talking about. But I guess the question I have is, where do you draw the line? Because there are certainly some people in history who should have been canceled very quickly. For instance, Adolf Hitler. That's my question for your experts, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
And that's a really important question, I think. Where do we draw the line? I think a lot of people, many people would agree that, you know, a certain class of people, serial pedophiles or somebody like that, of course, should be canceled. But then who else is on the list?
Well,
yeah, Judith and I were talking about that a little bit through the break, that Theo had mentioned earlier that cancel culture and call out culture kind of exist on a spectrum. You know, there's things on the end that are extreme that, of course, should be canceled and absolutely deserve to be canceled. But then as you start to go down the line, there is that question of where is the line and how do we address that gray area? At what point does it change from you're canceled and there's nothing we can do to even like help you? And although I don't know if I want to use the word help, but and then where do we start saying, okay, maybe we should talk about it and things like that?
Well, and I'm thinking that, you know, we are canceling people that have died 200 years ago. So you think about Andrew Jackson trying to remove him from the $20 bill and bring Harriet Tubman, or, you know, now thinking about Thomas Jefferson and his relationship with Sally Hemings and the recognition that that was not a love relationship, right? That was a very one-sided relationship. So, again, we are still, I mean, you know, just because a person is gone, right, I think we still find ways to rewrite that history and cancel them to a certain extent as well.
Ben, thanks for bringing up that point. Go ahead, Judith.
I think it's important also to be aware of our own positionality in this, right? You know, as a white person, I might be more comfortable canceling, you know, like you said, a serial sexual pedophile than, you know, a white person who's a racist. I mean, how does our own, who we are as people, who how we identify, how does that figure into who we are comfortable canceling and what we are comfortable canceling someone over? I think that's a question that's really important to ask ourselves. You know, where do I stand in this debate?
Headed to Rick in Lincolnville. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Listening on the phone for quite a while, so I think some of these points have been covered. I'll try to be brief, but I'm actually the first year of boomers. So I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and I find it interesting in a way that the term cancel culture has become so vogue because I think it really originated possibly in the 60s, not the term, but the phenomenon. And I guess I would just kind of empathize with the young people on the phone and possibly ask their reaction. I think in the 60s, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the Vietnam War and the horrors of that, and various other social upheavals at the time, as a young person at that time, I think I found that with the anger and with the frustration that we really didn't have the energy or the time to be tolerant of views that we considered so appallingly heinous that we could say, well, let's talk to Richard Nixon about the war. Let's be empathetic to that view, or let's try to understand. Let's try to bring people together. We felt that things were so crucial, so devastatingly bad at the time for people of color, for women, and everyone else. So we just we didn't have time and couldn't really bother with trying to bring people together.
Sure, Rick. Yeah, I think you bring up a really great point, is that, you know, the urgency of the moment. Does the urgency feed into the rise of the cancel culture, the urgency that many people feel? Theo?
I think there is a sense of urgency, but I also think about how, the a lot of the people that we've canceled today have been engaged in these kinds of things for such a long time, right? It took a lot of women to come forward before we were able to cancel people like Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby. And, you know, I think when you're thinking about that in comparison with the civil rights movements and the movements of the 1960s, a lot of people, you actually saw that sort of violence happening in a very real time that did push, again, a certain kind of, I wouldn't say it was necessarily a cancel culture. It was very deeply a call out sort of circumstance. But I think, I think there's a push and a pull there.
Mm. Rick, thanks so much for your call. Trying to get a couple more opinions in before the end of the program. Here's a tweet. It's an authoritarian tactic being employed by those of a particular political bent as a means to silence the voices of those who hold a different view. This is America, where we have the unalienable right to freedom of speech, which under no circumstances should ever be infringed. That was on Twitter, and we're going to go to Portland and Kyle for a phone call. Hi, Kyle. If you can be fairly quick, that would be great.
Hi, absolutely. I just wanted to say that I feel like it's important to differentiate between canceling an individual when they do something offensive or that, society finds objectionable, versus an individual like the caller earlier who might have an unpopular campus opinion. Because, Roseanne Barr, for example, is a public figure who's responsible for being popular and drawing income and generating revenue. So it's okay as a society to say, no, you don't get to take Ambien and tweet, because we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hold up people who do that. Whereas an individual, who's maybe talking in a classroom or an academic forum or even at the Thanksgiving table, I think as a society, we owe everyone the right to speak their mind and have constructive dialogues.
So
about
Kyle, what you're saying is a different standard for celebrities and for the rest of us.
Yeah, and I think it should be, because celebrity is not something that you just get to have. It's something that's constantly earned by being worthy of praise and attention. And if you fail to do that by any standard, you just don't get it anymore.
Judith?
So it's an interesting position, because you're really arguing that we have public figures and we have private figures. And, when you look at ethics, there are different ethics for people who are in the public limelight and people who are not. Having said that, there are still individuals who hold viewpoints that are so extreme that maybe they're not rehabilitatable anymore. And that's the question we have to ask ourselves, is when do individuals go too far? Because it is possible for them to do that, too.
All right. Question here. A tweet from Lucy. And we really are almost out of time. So, Thea, I'm going to ask you to be really quick. What about environmental cancel culture? For example, we canceled plastic straws but still use plastic cups. What does this say about cancel culture and how helpful or unhelpful it really is?
I think what it actually says is, again, the lack of nuance. We can cancel certain things and certain things can be upheld. And so we have to, again, be more thoughtful in terms of what it is we cancel and what that ultimately, what the consequences of that are. What's the fallout going to be from that?
All right. Well, you guys have all been such great guests. Thank you so much for being here. The voice you just heard, Theo Green, assistant professor of sociology at Bowdoin College. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Judith Rosenbaum, associate professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at the University of Maine. And Liz Terrio, opinion editor for UMaine's student newspaper. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.